Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets where record volumes were traded. He says higher interest rates boosted the Canadian dollar. There was hot action on cocoa, soy, and corn. Inside Track Trading President Eric Haddock explains the role of cycles in trading. He says they're not precise, but can give you expected trends. He tells us what to look for in gold and silver. WolfStreet.com's Wolf Richter comments on interest rates, inflation, commercial real estate, and auto sales. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Misalgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how did the stock markets end the week?
Ended the week with a little mixed on Friday. You know, this is an option expiration day on the calendar quarter, so that's the third Friday of the month. And it's also futures expiration this week, and you just get these wild volatilities usually in the latter part of trading, and Friday was just exactly on the money there. Huge amount of volatility, market down half hour before the close, up and then back down again. So overall, a pretty good week for the markets in general. Things were there on the upside. And, you know, we've had leadership, if we talked about it, has been in the NASDAQ, the top half dozen stocks been carrying the market. But in this last 10 days, the Russell 2000 and some of the others have started to come to life. And getting a little bit of a breather on a few things, like Google is taking a bit of a breather. But the indices themselves, if we look at like the S&P and the NASDAQ 100, I'm getting upside exhaustion signals on the daily charts, and we haven't seen anything like this since back in November of 2021. You know, you can have a methodical uptrend and just continue pretty much indefinitely, but when you get that urgency on the part of investors to get in or get out, then we get some significant signals. So S&P and NASDAQ, we got those signals as of the end of this week. And, you know, looking back in previous tops, you typically build a small a bit of divergence at the top end. So you might settle back right now, retest the highs or take them out, and if there's no momentum in that second move and the volume isn't there, then a pretty good opportunity, I think, for a correction on the downside. And if we look at some of these inverse ETFs, like the SQQQ or the PSQ, they've given capitulation signals, just the inverse of what we'd expect. And, you know, individual stocks that have been leading along here, getting just individual signals there. Apple, Adobe, Microsoft, Tesla, Oracle, they're all kicking in here, so that the likelihood of this thing having a pause is looking pretty good right now.
In terms of volume, what did we see over the week?
Oh, volumes, I mean, really big, and I think you've probably hit some record volumes on Friday. Looking at, I don't have the final numbers in here, but just, you know, a huge amount of volatility in there. So, as I say, that's another thing. It, when, you know, it's that fear of missing out, the FOMO, that brings people on board. And the more volume you see at a top, the greater the chance that you're getting to that climactic point. And if you pull back and then bounce again, and you don't have volume to carry it forward, then that starts to look like a real distribution pattern. So, as I say, one wants to be pretty careful in here. Don't get any lead from things like the commitment of traders. Had some bullish numbers there about 4 weeks ago on the S&P, and a couple of weeks before that on the Dow futures contracts, where we had good constructive numbers for the COTs. But in that area right now, they've backed off, so there's no real guidance there.
What's happening with crude?
Crude, this is still stuck in a trading range. Here we are at $72. Middle of the week, it was down testing the bottom end of the recent range around 67. Looked as though it might have some follow-through, but no, we're back up again. The overall trend, as I'm looking at it, continues to be presented with a lid at that 20-week moving average, which is up around $75. So that's still $2.50, $3 from where we are right now. Best thing for me is that, and from our technicals, would be a new low for the move, ideally in the low 60s. And get a reversal from there. Now, the more oversold we can get here, the better off we'll be. And this downtrend has been in place for well over a year. And it'd be nice to have a really good washout at the bottom end of the move there.
What's happening with gold and silver?
Similar action there. We had gold and silver down during the middle of the week. Gold managed to reverse back to the middle of this trading range that we've been in. So there's, as I say, I don't think anything really exciting right now. Seasonally, we would hope for a break into July, maybe into as early as August, but ideally be looking at a July low for those precious metals. And in particular, for the mining stocks, because the reversals out of a low here should see some very, very nice action. And on our big models show that, given months and down the road here, when we break out, assuming that we do, through $2,100, there is going to just be open space on the upside, blue sky, and there's some pretty good upside objectives that we've got. We put that out in a piece a week ago, just giving people some parameters in terms of what to be looking for when we manage to clear this resistance that we've had for the last couple of years.
What are we looking at for the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Okay, so the U.S. dollar was holding up reasonably well until about a week ago, and then this week it's taken it on the nose. The dollar index, we've been up around 104, now we're under 102, so we're back approaching that double bottom that we've put in the first half of this year. Got a little oversold at the end of the week. And if we take a look at it, the Canadian had its best week in quite a while, up to 75 3/4. So that's a breakout of this long trading range that we've had. For me, a little bit of a surprise. I didn't think we were going to manage to push through there, but it has. Clearly buoyed up by the move on the Canadian rate being interest rate going up a week ago, and then the U.S. rate being held this week. So you've got a move for the Canadian. But it really, if you look at it, we are moving with everybody else. You've had this move in the British pound, the yen, the Mexican peso. They're all moving against this U.S. dollar. And clearly, of the big currencies, the Mexican peso is just the winner by a long shot. Not very good for Canadians who'd like to have their summer or their winter holidays down south. So let's hope that things bounce back a little bit between now and when you do your bookings.
I'm a chocoholic, kind of. I know people who can't get through their day without chocolate. What's the front? What's the news there?
Well, you know, cocoa has been on a pretty good tear from about what 22.50 up to 32 and change right now. So, and that's in a span of just from the beginning of the year. So, pretty big move from the chocolate side of things. This gets back towards the top, so 10% of the trading range that we've had over the last many decades. So. You know, I don't think chocolate bars hold up too well if you're going to try and store them, but having a stock of chocolate bars right now might not be a bad idea.
Anything happening else on the agricultural front?
Well, you know, we had, was it 4 weeks ago, we got these nice buy signals in wheat and soybeans on this commitment traders numbers, and 2 weeks before that it was in corn. And if we look at what's going on here, we've got, you know, corn's up 17% here in the last 5 weeks. Soybean oil is up 26%. This is actually outpacing what's happening over in the S&P, where everybody's so excited about what's happening in the stock market this last few weeks. But, you know, when you get an overbalance here of speculators short and commercials long, it can really be a catalyst for the move. And so these greens had rallied into very well into about a week and a half ago, took a short pause, and have come to life again. So, you know, when you see those kind of numbers, you got to jump on them and take advantage of them. So, you know, right now, we're kind of waiting for something new to show up. But for now, the grain market's been really nice to us.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Always nice to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Eric Haddock, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Eric.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
Before we get into the interview, can you tell us a little bit about InsideTrack?
InsideTrack is a educational and advisory service with the primary focus on futures markets, but really incorporating a wide array of financial markets and commodity markets, stock indexes, foreign currencies, cryptos, all of that. But one of our primary focus is to not only inform our readers, but to try and educate them in using technicals and cycles the way that I use them, so that they've got a better understanding of how the analysis is evolving and how conclusions are drawn.
You talk a lot about cycles in our conversations. How do you define cycles, and are they your primary tool for analysis?
That's a great question. That's really at the base of our publications, of my analysis. To start, cycles, I will start out defining what they are not. But the gist of that is that I don't treat them as a holy grail. I don't treat them as a very specific tool, that they are more of a backdrop or something that builds the foundation on which analysis and trading strategies can be developed. I look at cycles, the term cycles, I treat more as an interval between recurring phenomenon, whether that be in the markets, intervals between specific highs, specific lows, meltdowns or parabolic advances, but that recurring phenomenon also applies to everything that I analyze, from various war cycles and solar cycles, geophysical cycles, geopolitical cycles. So it's that the first focus is on those, the intervals between those recurring phenomenon and the consistent periodicity of that interval, that many things happen on a very regular basis, even though people don't recognize it. It's often a little bit disguised, but not completely. And so there is certain anticipation that you can develop with regard to those phenomena. And that's really how I define cycles. And like I said, how I use it in my work is as a backdrop. It sets the stage for more specific indicators and tools to then be applied. It's kind of telling you when those other tools should be implemented, when they're most effective. You know, it's any technical trader has probably encountered that there are certain indicators that work real well in a trending market, and as soon as you get into a consolidation market, they just end up triggering a lot of false signals, signals that don't have follow through. And conversely, you may have indicators that work very well in a congested market, and you can kind of trade swings within it. They're a little bit more top-picking and bottom-picking type of indicators. But when you go into a trending market, you're going to get your butt handed to you trying to trade it like it's a congested market. So cycles help to define when to utilize certain tools. And they also help me just kind of build up a trading strategy in increments as you're coming into those cycle periods and as you're heading out of them. It's kind of like if you were getting ready to do a road trip across the state or across the province in your case, and you kind of did an initial assessment and you knew it was going to be about 250 miles and it was going to be 3 hours driving. You don't just get in your car, drive for 3 hours or drive for 250 miles and expect to be exactly where you expected to be. As you get near that time frame, as that trip reaches fruition, now you start to implement other tools to get you where you want to be. And so that's a lot how I utilize cycles in my trading. And again, I don't treat them as a holy grail. I don't treat them as a standalone trading tool. In fact, that's one of the things that I really stress to my readers is don't try to trade off of cycles. You need other more specific, more objective tools and indicators and things that are going to help you accurately define risk parameters and just a general money management tools for trading, since it's more than just being right or wrong, more than just buying and selling. It's controlling your risk and managing your money and putting it all together.
A few months ago, you revisited your approach to the natural year and how it can impact key markets. Can you explain that term and give an update on what it means for the markets?
Yes. The natural year is a kind of an agricultural-based year. It's something that was more in use and in application 100 years ago. Even within a lot of the financial markets, many of them were commodity-based 100 years ago. And so farming and agricultural had a much bigger impact. And so the natural year is something that starts with the vernal equinox, the start of spring each year, and flows through to the start of spring in the ensuing year. So it starts on March 20th, 21st in one year and flows through to that time frame in the next. One of the things that I look for with that and the way in which I utilize it is applying a an opening range tool that I also use to the calendar year. And what I mean by that is I watch the first month of that natural year. So from March 20th, 21st, and to April 19th, 20th. That April 19th date has its own significance that we've talked about a lot in the past. I call it the date of aggression. But that also culminates the first month of the natural year. And in a lot of markets, once you have gone through that first month, you've set a trading range that gives you specific parameters and even some expectations for the 11 months, the remainder of that natural year that followed. And I've seen this in so many markets. There's even been a lot of them that set very significant tops and bottoms right on the beginning of that natural year. Perfect example and something that I've been talking about in recent months are some key stock indexes. And you go back to 3 years ago at the depths of the COVID sell-off, and when did all the stock indexes bottom? They bottomed right between March 20th and 24th of 2020, right at the beginning of that natural year. They saw an initial surge into April 19th, 20th, set the opening range, and then once they broke above that range, it built a lot of expectations for what to anticipate for the next 10, 11 months. That low was an influencing factor on particularly one index that I watch a lot for some more disguised signals, and that's the Russell 2000. And when you came into late March of this year, the Russell also had a very consistent three-month, 90-degree cycle that I was watching that was telling me it should set a multi-month bottom right in that March 20th to the 24th time frame. And so it was not only the fulfillment of one of these recurring phenomenon, this three-month cycle, but it was also a very natural cycle that has timed critical turning points in a lot of markets. Sure enough, the Russell 2000 bottomed right in that March 20th to the 24th time frame, rallied from there, set an initial range between that low and the high of the first month. And along with that cycle, it was expected to advance on balance. Doesn't mean it's going straight up, but it means that the next significant high should be 3 months later, a continuation of that three-month cycle around June 20th to the 24th. There were other cycles that and timing indicators that honed that time frame a little bit, but the general expectation was that that cycle would create the next critical top right around that June 20th to the 24th time frame in the Russell 2000. Once it broke above its opening range high, the high of that first month between March 20th and April 19th, once it broke above that high, it confirmed that assessment, that expectation, and then corroborating indicators were kicking in at the same time. But it also now sets a very important and decisive support level from now through March of next year, and that is that low from March 20th, 24th. I think it actually set kind of a double bottom right in there. And so that's another way that you utilize that, using the opening range and using the initial low as pivotal support points moving forward. And there's other things that build expectations around that. This is just one tool that I'm describing, but it's been uncanny how that natural year has impacted a lot of markets, and it's even more significant in a lot of your agricultural markets, your grains, your livestock. And so as I said, it's not just looking for a major bottom or major top at the beginning of that time frame, the beginning of that natural year, but it's utilizing the first few weeks of that natural year has a key litmus test and a support or resistance zone for the 11 months that follow that. So that's kind of where I'm at with that, and what I was discussing back in late March about why the stock indexes were entering another bullish period. The NASDAQ 100 and a couple other indexes had already signaled bottoms on March 13th, 14th, along with their own cycles. And that's the other thing, that the equity market's full of divergence where they're rarely topping and bottoming at the same time. And so this was one of those where the weaker market, the Russell 2000 at the time, extended its decline a little bit, set a low a little later than the others, but then corroborated what was expected between then and June. So it also tells us, obviously, that we're entering a pivotal time frame in the equity markets.
Since January, your Inside Track newsletter has been discussing the likelihood for a series of stock market rallies in the first half of the year. Have your upside targets been met, or is there more to come?
One of the things that I've laid out in recent weeks and months is several criteria that needed to be met before you could even start talking about an intermediate top in stock indexes. And like I was saying, we had those mid-March to late-March cycle lows and buy signals that were triggered. Even before that, coming into the beginning of the year, you had a strong convergence of cycles that I documented in my January Inside Track. It was showing how the NASDAQ 100, the Russell 2000, several other indexes were all poised to set significant lows right at the beginning of the year and start moving up from there. In the same way that I was just describing that first month of the natural year, I also used the first month. I even honed that a little bit down to the first 3 weeks of the calendar year. And once the range of those first 3 weeks is set, if a market gives a weekly close above that range, it's now in an intra-year uptrend. And there are specific rules and expectations that flow from that, and that can then be applied for unfolding market action. But those stock indexes confirm that. They closed above that opening range. And from a very general standpoint, an intra-year uptrend often propels a market, whatever that market may be, propels it into the middle of the year. So into the June-July timeframe, a little more specifically into the mid-June through mid-July timeframe, that's when you would be looking for that intra-year uptrend to reach fruition, to have a culmination at least for a couple months. And there's specific price indicators that go along with that to determine whether it has expended the majority of its upside energy or if there's more to come after a pullback. But that was part of the initial general setting the tone outlook for the stock indexes leading into June of this year. It was kind of like the analogy that I was just using, that initial assessment of a road trip. And it's like, okay, there's 250 miles, 3 hours, or 5 to 6 months for the market to head in one direction before starting to look for tools that might identify a top and then ultimately identify a signs of a reversal lower. Right now, we're still in kind of a almost a blow-off stage of that uptrend. Some of the indexes have shot beyond their respective daily and weekly cycles. Some of them are just coming into those daily and weekly cycles. So we're in a specific time frame when I think we could see a pretty significant top. I've already explained why there's certain monthly indicators that in July will start to turn a bit negative, and have also explained a specific time frame when I think you could see the next low in the equity markets. And often, if you are in a move like we've seen now, where it has extended for 6 months, the reactions lower, the sell-offs are sometimes quicker and sharper. And so it wouldn't surprise me to see the market kind of go through a topping process in here for a little while. Then if and when it finally triggers some respective sell signals in the different indexes, that you then see a quick, sharp drop into this next cycle low. And that would then be used to better hone or enhance the outlook for the remainder of the year and the outlook stretching into 2024. So we're definitely getting into those time frames and getting up to some extreme upside price targets. A couple of the targets that I was looking at, one was in the Russell 2000, getting up to around 1930 to 1940. And another was in the S&P Mid-Cap 400. There were several wave targets and price targets around the 2580 to 2600 level, and then some respective targets in the S&P 500, NASDAQ 100, Dow Industrials. So we're getting near those levels, and that's when I start looking for any signs of a top or reversal lower.
In April, you were explaining why gold and silver should set important peaks in early May. That appears to have taken hold. So what's the outlook now?
Gold and silver leading into this year had a few specific cycle time frames when I expected intermediate turning points in 2023. Some years you come into and there's maybe one or two that are clear and others start to take form as the year unfolds. This was one of those years where right from the start, there was some very clear indication of when gold and silver should see intermediate turning points and a little bit larger magnitude turning points. The first peak was expected in January in silver, February in gold, and then a sell-off from there into March. But once gold triggered some buy signals in early March, it was on track to go into the next set of cycle highs in early May. And it was just a very convincing synergy of these timing indicators, not just these cycles or these intervals of recurring phenomenon, but also several price time indicators that I use, where when a market does move a certain magnitude within a certain time frame, it projects similar price and time moves from there looking forward, and those were aligning right in that same time frame in early May. The price targets were very clear as well. And gold and silver adhered very closely to that, giving a final spike high right in the May 3rd, May 4th time frame, right to their upside price targets. And that convinced me that we were going to see at least a 1 to 2 month peak and potentially a longer peak in gold and silver at that time. Looking forward from there, there were three other key time frames that have been in focus. One is more intermediate based and comes in early July, but two key time frames beyond that early May cycle that I've been watching all year. One is in late August, early September, and I think that should be a significant low in gold and silver. And the other is out in late October, early November, when I think that a more significant peak is expected. So those cycles give me, again, just the very general backdrop and already price action has been starting to add specifics to that, that add some meat to that skeleton of an outlook for the year, and giving me more practical and usable expectations and data and analysis to determine what to expect between those time frames. And so we've got gold and silver already starting to dictate what is likely over the next few weeks. Right now we're in a rebound phase, but there's some specific criteria for when that could culminate. And then for what's expected leading into that late August, early September timeframe. And so I think you're going to see a volatile trading range in gold and silver. There are a couple specific times when I think you could see some accelerated moves, but the majority of that timeframe is going to be some trading range markets.
Where can listeners get more information on Inside Track and the Weekly Relay?
Best place to get any information and a lot of samples, a lot of educational material and tutorials is on our primary website at insidetracktrading.com. That's inside with the extra I in the middle, so it's INSIIDE, tracktrading.com.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you for having me back, Jim.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and President of InsideTrackTrading.com. Coming up, Wolf Richter next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Wolf, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back.
Wolf, last week the Bank of Canada started raising interest rates again. This week the Fed paused. Could we see higher interest rates and more credit constriction ahead?
Yeah, so it seems on a pattern of pausing and then unpausing. The Bank of Canada has paused and then unpaused. The Reserve Bank of Australia has done that. It paused and then it hiked a couple of times since then. The Fed paused. It was called a very hawkish skip because it indicated two more rate hikes this year, first one likely in July. So, I mean, they're slowing down the rate hikes after the fast moves last year and into early this year. And so they decided, and it makes sense when you think about it, because rates have, in the United States especially, have come up a whole lot. You know, they've come up by 5 percentage points. And so they decided they need to let everything adjust a little bit and let the economy, let the banks, let companies and consumers adjust to those higher rates and see where inflation is going, and they're going to slow down the increases. And that's really interesting from all kinds of points of views, because that will likely mean that the economy will not go into a recession. It will likely mean that as everything adjusts to it, economic growth will continue and inflation will stay higher. It may go even higher than where we're now. And inflation has ticked up again in Canada. It's starting to resurge in Australia. We have seen inflation in the United States, core inflation, remain roughly unchanged for 7 months. It hasn't come down at all despite those rate increases. So we've got this situation where now the higher for longer is much higher for much longer now. You know, this is what they're doing. It's slowing down the rate hikes to not cause economic damage. At the same time, it will maintain economic growth and consumer spending and pressure on inflation. And so, you know, they're going to take the long, slow approach with higher rates and staying high for a much longer period. Inflation sort of, you know, getting baked into the economy and into everything we do. You know, and people are getting used to it. The inflation rate we're looking at in the United States on a core basis, yeah, is at 5%. And that's not, you know, that's not hyperinflation. So that is something an economy can deal with. And if rates stay above 5%, which is where they're right now, you know, that system can go on for a long time. And it will help reduce the burden of government debt everywhere. You know, that's what they're looking at. Government spent trillions of dollars, borrowed trillions of dollars during the pandemic. And what do you do with it? And what they're doing with it, you know, they're allowing inflation to run hot. They're keeping interest rates high and so that inflation doesn't go out of whack. And then, you know, this will go on for a few years. And the burden during that time, the burden of the government debt on the economy and on taxpayers are all getting higher wages, you know, and higher prices in the economy. So the burden of the debt will come down. And I think that's the theory behind all this.
There's been a lot of talk about commercial real estate getting into trouble, banks being exposed to it. How worried are you about commercial real estate?
Well, so commercial real estate falls in different categories, and some of them are doing pretty good. But the ones that are running into trouble or have run into trouble is office, is retail, so shopping malls, that kind of thing, and hospitality, so hotels, motels. And retail has been in horrible shape for years. So that started in 2017. We had all kinds of department stores and other retailers go bankrupt and vanish, you know. And so we had tens of thousands of stores closed, and lots of malls went bankrupt, you know, with zombie malls everywhere. I mean, this is a real issue. Small retail stores or street-level retailers in big cities like in San Francisco and New York City having a heck of a time. You know, there were a lot of them shut it. And this happens because of e-commerce took over a big portion of retail, and that's not reversible. That's not going to change. We just got the new retail figures today, and e-commerce is hitting it out of the ballpark month after month, even as other retailers starting to have trouble, and so this is has an impact on real estate, on commercial real estate. So you have the retail sector that's really troubled, with default rates among commercial mortgage-backed securities, you know, and in the double digits during the bad periods, and now it's 7% and going back up. I mean, it's a huge default rate that's been going on for years. At the same time, commercial real estate in the industrial sector, so that's warehouses, fulfillment center, the kind of stuff that e-commerce uses, that has been red hot. And with minuscule default rates, or none essentially, and surging prices. Now, we've seen it cool down a little bit recently, but it's still a very healthy part of the commercial real estate part. So that's retail. The office sector is a new development that started during the pandemic, actually, when working from home started, and all these companies realized that the empty office space that they were leasing or buying, that they were expecting to grow into over the next few years, they're not going to grow into. You know, they're not going to do that. Working from home is taking over, at least partially. Hybrid models are being used widely. They don't need all this office space, and they've pulled back from it. They put the stuff on the market. So we have seen commercial real estate, so office-backed debt get in trouble. They've defaulted. The office towers that are now selling at discounts of 70% in San Francisco and 50 or 30% in that range in New York City. Some of them essentially sold for nearly nothing, because they have to be torn down. You know, there's an office tower in St. Louis that sold at a foreclosure auction at next to nothing, and the largest office tower in St. Louis, Missouri. You know, so this is a sector that's in real trouble, and a lot of these office towers will have to be torn down and redeveloped into residential, so they might sell for land value. That doesn't heal. Yeah, that doesn't go back. There's a real opportunity there but where we are right now, that has to unfold. You know, these holders of this debt will take the losses. The equity holders will take the losses. There'll be new developers coming in, redeveloping it. We have one shopping mall, for example, in San Francisco, that's getting converted into residential, 3,000 housing units. You know, this kind of stuff is easy to do with retail and shopping malls, but it's very hard to do with office towers. It's very hard to convert an office tower, an older office tower, into residential. So a lot of stuff gets torn down, and then the debt essentially becomes worthless. And so who carries the debt? The interesting thing is, now we're worried about the banks, but the debt that has blown up so far hasn't been held by the banks. That was held by commercial mortgage-backed securities. So that was debt that had been sold, had been securitized and sold to investors, to bond funds, to bond mutual funds, to pension funds, life insurers, etc. And what banks have done is that they have taken this high-risk debt, mortgages on office towers, backed by overvalued appraisals, and they've taken those, they've issued the mortgages, they've sliced and diced those mortgages, and they've sold them to investors. And so far, all of the big office problems that we've run into with debt, you know, all the big defaults and the foreclosure sales and all that has hit commercial mortgage-backed security holders, not banks. And it has hit some mortgage REITs and not banks. And so the losses have been borne by investors and not banks so far. Banks are sitting on some problems too, but you know they retained the better mortgages. They retained the better quality mortgages, the high risk stuff they got rid of, and that's what we're seeing unfold right now. Eventually, you know, banks will report bigger losses on their commercial real estate holdings, but so far, you know, it's been investors that have gotten hit, and you know, that's been going on with retail for years. You know, the biggest mall landlords have walked away from malls that were funded by mortgages that were sliced and diced into mortgage-backed securities. Now, that's been happening since 2019, and you know, investors took the losses. Banks were completely unscathed by this. So right now, I'm not seeing banks at the risky end of all this. And it's investors that piled into the risky end, and they're getting cleaned out. And so banks are, you know, they're going to eventually have to deal with some of that. And there will probably be some smaller banks that are concentrated in this, and some of them will fail. There's always some bank failures nearly every year in the United States. Now, we have 4,000 banks, so there's a bunch of them that are going to eventually disappear. And so at this point, you know, it's investors that are taking the losses.
Could commercial real estate problems cause even greater problems in residential real estate?
Yeah, so what we're seeing in commercial real estate in terms of residential commercial real estate, so that's multifamily and that single family rentals, they've had a huge construction boom, and they're catering to the higher end. So they're catering to renters of choice, people that have good incomes that want to rent for a variety of reasons. And in multifamily buildings, you're talking about high-end apartment towers in city centers. And, the rents are high in those, and they offer all sorts of amenities, and it's very practical to live there. And so lots of people choose to do that. And there has been a huge construction boom in this. And what we're seeing now is that people have a choice between buying an overpriced house or renting a very nice apartment with a beautiful view in a brand new building and with all sorts of amenities. And we're seeing some arbitrage there. You know, people are selling the homes at these high prices. And I've heard all kinds of stories about this, and we're seeing it, you know, and they're renting. They're moving into a rental because, you know, they're going to wait this out. And plus, you know, there's many advantages in rentals. You don't have to worry about anything. There's no maintenance. You know, if you live in an older house, there's always something to fix. And you don't have that with a rental property. You don't worry about property taxes. I mean, the landlord has to deal with that. So, I mean, there's rentals of choice, lots of them. And in all the expensive cities, you know, rentals are very expensive. And, I mean, a two-bedroom apartment Francisco, you're looking at $5,000, and you know, that's not for people who don't have money. You know, and so these are, and in New York City, you know, in Manhattan, it's the same thing. You know, and so yeah, what we're seeing is an arbitrage taking place from home ownership to higher end rentals. And I think that will eventually have some impact on the home prices and the housing market in general. We're also seeing an arbitrage between home ownership and single family rentals. And you know, we've got landlords, the biggest ones in the country. You know, one of them just ordered 4,000 new rental houses, and you know, they're nice houses, and they're going to be built for rentals. On purpose, built to rent, and so the finishes and so forth will be maybe a little bit cheaper than you would in a home that you would sell, and you know, that will put pressure on, and it's been putting pressure on the housing market too, and you know, you're seeing sales have plunged, prices still up, but sales have plunged, you know, and home sales, and in part because you see this switch to the rental market. It's a lot cheaper to rent a nice place than it is to buy it.
Are there other signs that the corporate sector is starting to feel the financial stress from higher rates?
Yeah, so you know, the big companies that are in good financial shape, they don't feel that. But the junk-rated companies, they're you know, they've been in trouble for years, but they've been getting by because they could get their bonds refinanced, and people were chasing yield and took huge risks. Well, that's coming apart now, and we've seen a surge in bankruptcy of these junk-rated, troubled companies. Some of the big ones include Bed Bath and Beyond, and I mean, they've been skirting bankruptcy for a while, and so bankruptcy filings through May this year have essentially doubled from last year. Now, last year was sort of a record low. It came out of the pandemic funding when anybody could still fund anything and roll over any kind of loan or any kind of bond, and so that's really a bad comparison. But it was the highest since the same period in 2010. It was a little bit higher than the same period in 2020, you know, when we had a variety of pandemic-related bankruptcies. So it is definitely meaningful now that at the junk-rated spectrum of the corporate sector, we're seeing you know, more failures, and these are companies that have to refinance at much higher rates, and the loans are still available, and the bonds are still, they still issue bonds, but they have to pay much higher rates now for these, and you know, that becomes, they already couldn't meet the interest payments on the lower rates, and they have to borrow more money to make interest payments, and so that's now all getting a lot more difficult, and that's why we're seeing the bankruptcies. And then in a way, I think that's a good thing. You know, every economic cycle has the cycle where you just blow out the cobwebs, you know, or use some different metaphors or get rid of the deadwood, as we say. Now, what that will do is it will allow these companies to restructure in bankruptcy court and get rid of their debts at investors' expense. And companies that cannot be restructured, such as Bed Bath & Beyond, you know, they will essentially be liquidated. And that's a good thing too, because you know, if you can't run a business, you need to get out. And you know, if you ruin your brand to where people don't want to buy there anymore, you know, you need to get out. And bankruptcy is an orderly process that more or less orderly process for that kind of exit when a company fails.
There's core inflation, and then there's inflation on things we actually need, like food and energy. What's really happening with inflation in the U.S.?
Well, the good news is energy prices have plunged. Gasoline's down, you know, 20% plus from a year ago. Electricity is down. Natural gas is down. Heating oil, everything has plunged in price. So that's why the headline inflation numbers in the United States and elsewhere, you know, in Canada, in Europe, everywhere, have dropped sharply because the collapse in energy prices, and that was a true collapse after the spike. You know, so we have this huge spike in energy prices, and the spike just unwound. And so prices came down very, very hard, and so that has pulled down the overall inflation figures. The food inflation also spiked, and so we have recently seen in the United States that food prices are coming down, and they're at very high levels, but they have started to come down, and so that too helped push down overall inflation numbers. So consumers like that. You know, the gasoline and food are the two most in-your-face type prices that people get really pissed off about when they rise, and they have come down, so that people are happy about that. But in terms of core inflation, now that's the underlying inflation, that's services, that's housing, that's insurance, healthcare. It's all these things where people really spent their money on, and they may not, you know, pay that much attention to it, but that's where a big portion of the money goes. And that has been relentlessly high. And it really hasn't moved down at all in the United States in 7 months. In Canada, it's gone back up. In the United States, too, the last 2 months, you know, it went back up a little bit. And so that's been incredibly frustrating because these things, you know, that people really spent a lot of the income on, housing, insurance, the things that they need, the services, you know, what used to be free, like Netflix now requires a subscription. You know, you could get it, you could log in with your mother's account. You know, now you have to pay for it separately. And all these kinds of things. You know, every service I subscribe to in my little company has gone up between 10 and 20% recently. I mean, these are the things that don't really show up in when you go to the store, but that show up in your bank account when you pay for it. And they have been relentlessly going higher. And, that's what the central banks are worried about. They're not worried about gasoline and food anymore. They're going down. They're worried about the underlying inflation in services. And, you know, some goods prices have started to come up again. And, and services are 70% or, you know, 2/3 roughly of what consumers spend their money on. So this is a big thing. And that's not coming down at all. You know, that's just not coming down and has been. Inflation has gotten entrenched there, and that's why we're saying, you know, interest rates are going to be higher for longer because this inflation in services is not going to just vanish, and that's the difference now between core inflation and overall inflation. You know, core inflation is now much higher than overall inflation. So the things that include food and energy, the overall inflation measures, they have dropped so hard that they're now below core inflation, and core inflation is runs around 5% in the United States.
Are the vehicle markets a leading indicator to watch, and what's happening in the new and used vehicle markets?
Yeah, so the new vehicle market, you know, that was marked by shortages during late 2020 through the entire year of 2021 and through most of 2022. So due to the semiconductor shortages and so component shortages, and so the market back then actually ran out of new vehicles, and that had impacted not only new vehicles but also used vehicles, because new vehicles become used vehicles, you know, rental companies especially, rental fleets are buying 2 to 3 million new vehicles every year in the United States, and a year or two later, those new vehicles become used vehicles. They're sold at auction, they're sold directly by the rental agencies, and that was all screwed up. So because of the supply shortages, now the new vehicle supply is strong. You know, it's back to normal. Vehicles are piling up in most manufacturers. Now, Toyota and some others still have some problems. But many manufacturers, especially with pickup trucks and big SUVs, are now having a huge pile of inventory, and incentives are being heaped on them to sell more of them. Sales are coming up because of the incentives. So prices, new vehicle prices are coming down a little bit because of those incentives. On the EV side, Tesla has cut its prices several times. Other EV makers have fallen in line with that and also cut prices. So we see pricing pressure in the new vehicle market build, meaning downward pricing pressure after the huge spike we've had. So they're unwinding some of that spike. And it's, anywhere, if you cut price enough, they will come, and you can sell anything if the price is right. So when there's enough supply, and they're starting to cut prices. Those new vehicles are moving, and consumers are pretty happy about those price cuts. You can go to a dealer now, and you have a choice of 100 pickup trucks, you know, and they'll make you deals, and especially Ram dealers, you know, that's just for consumers, that's a good place to be. That finally this stuff is coming back. The dealers are making deals again. The manufacturers are putting incentives on their vehicles. And I'm glad to see that. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating than the shortages we've run into. And to see that normalized, that's a good thing. On the used vehicle market, you know, we're still having the constraint from the rental fleet supply not coming in, because they were supply constrained back in 2021 and 2022, so that we're not getting that flow into the used vehicle market. So the prices plunged there for a while, but the last 2 months, retail prices have jumped. the last 2 months, we saw used vehicle CPI jump by 9%, from the 2 months earlier. That's a huge spike, in part because there's demand for used vehicles and there's not a lot of supply, that market will still be screwed up for a while until the new vehicles that are now being built and that are now on the lot are becoming used vehicles. And that'll take a year or two. So, there's plenty of demand. There is lots of supply now on the new vehicle side, which is good. There's still, tight supply in used vehicles, and that's a problem. And now on the credit side, what we've seen is that the subprime rated customers are starting to run out of options a little bit. If you're prime rated, you can afford a 7% car loan, you'll get it. There's no problem. But subprime customers who have almost exclusively bought used vehicles, they're having trouble getting funded, and so but that's a very small portion of the market. It's like 15% of the market, and so it's not a big deal. And they're still getting loans, but there's just a little bit of a reduction there. But that's really the only place where we can see the problem. Manufacturers are offering 3.9% financing now as part of the incentives. And so they're buying down the rates, and that's appealing to a lot of people on new vehicles. You don't have those kinds of deals on used vehicles, so you have to pay whatever the lenders give you. And those rates have come up a lot. And for most people, that may not be a huge issue, but there are groups of people that are essentially now cut out of the market there.
With the old definition of recession, are the U.S. and Canada in recession?
Well, I don't know about the old definition. In the United States, we've had the same definition for many, many decades, for longer than I've been alive. And it's always been a broad definition. You need a broad decline in the economy that includes a decline in the labor market, not just a technical decline in GDP. We've had a quarter there last year when imports, which had this huge surge in imports through that stimulus spending, consumers bought consumer products, nearly all of which are imported, and so we have this explosion of imports, and imports are negative on GDP, and so that pulled down GDP and imports, a sign of demand, but the way the GDP math works, they're negative, they're subtracted from GDP. And so we have this negative GDP reading because of the surge in imports. And so that's not a recession. We had labor shortages, we had huge demand, we had consumer spending going up, we had all the things, And at the same time, because of this quirk in imports, we had a negative GDP reading. So that's not a recession, We're not looking at a recession now. We've got strong demand. We've got a labor market that's still hot and tight. Unemployment rates are come up a little bit, but they're at historic lows, And so there's no way the United States can be in a recession now. The Fed did see a recession coming earlier. It now has discarded that view and is not seeing a recession coming either. In Canada, there's there's been talk about this per capita recession, because you've had this huge surge in immigrants. And so if you divide your GDP by the number of people in the country, the slices get smaller when the number of people grow. And so you have this little per capita recession, but in terms of overall GDP, it's pretty strong. And it just doesn't look like a recessionary economy. We would need to see the labor market weakening substantially over a long period of time, not just 1 or 2 months, but over a substantial period of time. And we really haven't seen that yet.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Wolf Richter, and Eric Haddock. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarko Masalgia. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico. Welcome back to Company Showcase.
Thank you, Jim.
Zarko, exciting things happening around Recyclico?
Yes, I know we've all eagerly been anticipating a podcast like this for quite some time, and I am thrilled to share that it's all falling into place. You know, the signing of our first commercial joint venture agreement with Zenith has really gotten me really excited. I think this 50-50 JV marks a major milestone for our company and the advancement of our battery recycling technology. And, I think we can see this response, and the response of the recent news has been overwhelmingly positive, with our stock price experiencing a fantastic boost. And it looks like the entire sector is really starting to heat up, presenting us with a great opportunity to build upon this momentum. But, just really well on this JV and how it all came to be, since signing an MOU with Zenith in February of last year, we've been really working closely together. Our collaboration actually reached a critical milestone when our technical due diligence was successfully demonstrated. And the way this was done was actually Zenith had sent our precursor samples to a prominent Asian battery materials company, which confirmed that our materials perform at the same level as commercial grade precursors. Now it's clear that the Asian battery industry is very advanced, and this validation from a major battery materials company in Asia is really a testament to the advanced nature of our technology and its readiness to make a significant impact in the market on a commercial scale. I think it's also opened up an exciting opportunity for us to source battery waste and produce battery ready materials for the thriving Asian battery market. We've also emphasized the importance of technical due diligence. I think in many podcasts before, and we continue to work with numerous others interested in similar commercial models. Now, our business model, as a reminder, revolves around integrating our recycling technology with strategic companies worldwide. And I think taking the first step is often the most challenging, but with this initial deal, we have now a considerable amount of momentum on our side. Now, just for those maybe who are just listening for the first time or haven't read the news release in full detail, just to quickly recap on the details of the agreement. So Recyclico and Zenith will be forming a 50-50 joint venture to establish a lithium-ion battery recycling plant in Taiwan. the plant will have an input processing capacity of 2,000 metric tons per year of input, so of black mass material, with an estimated cost of $25 million. The plant will be situated on the existing land and infrastructure also owned by Zenith in Taiwan. Now, I really want to highlight that significance of partnering with Zenith because they are an established company that already produces nickel-based chemicals for, you know, just like nickel sulfate for lithium-ion batteries. They also have a strong partnerships with companies like Hanwha, which is a large publicly traded Japanese company that does specialize in, you know, lithium-ion battery materials and the trade of those materials, and as well as Central Glass, which has expertise in fluorine-based chemicals that and also caters to the lithium-ion battery market. Now, by leveraging Zenith's existing infrastructure and supply network in combination with our know-how and technology, I think we've really found an ideal partnership that positions us several steps ahead. And we've already begun working through the checklist of corporate and design-related items. And I firmly believe that the dynamic nature of both companies will enable us to move efficiently towards production. So, I have great optimism for the future and the positive impact we can make together.
Zarco, for people who are new to Recyclico, can you tell us more about the company?
Yeah, Recyclico is a battery materials company focused on the recycling and upcycling of lithium-ion battery waste to produce battery-ready materials for the reintegration into new lithium-ion battery manufacturing.
Where can people get more information about Recyclico and where are you traded?
You can get more information on our website at www.recyclico.com, and we're traded on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under 2AM.
Zarco, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
I've been speaking with Zarco Masalgia, CEO of Recyclico. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on June 16th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.